Pizza Noir by Denver Day, Book 1, Chapter 14. I cleared out of the office about 7, ate dinner at the diner, and drove over to MC's to see whom I might see. It was a warm relief to be among the Thursday evening crowd and out of the rain. I didn't see Alvarez in there, but I recognized a couple of the waitresses as off-duty Tacoma Liquors, particularly my new friend Kitty Liquor, whose MC's alehouse uniform looked a lot the same as her derby colors. But for this gig, she wore black canvas high tops, not skates. Note to self, I thought, gotta keep an eye out for Eastern Bloc suits and bookmakers in here, too. I sat at the bar, but Kitty diverted my business from the barkeep. She brought me a neat single malt and brought one for herself, which she sipped and sat next to mine. I'll be right back, she said. The whiskey was warm in my belly and there was a good hockey on the telly. Momentarily, returned Kitty, who finished off her glass and asked for my card, which I gave her. Then she asked me to write the address of my apartment on the back of it, which I did. I'll be over this morning about 1. Your drink's on the house. She turned on her heel and walked off. I didn't recognize the nice bartender or any of the patrons, for that matter. I finished my glass and headed out, drove over to the Diddler, and as the clock crowded 8, it too was developing a healthy Thursday evening crowd. The stripper pier was lit up and the music was cranked. A blonde wearing a pink thong and feathered high-laced strappy sandals spun around on one of the poles until she just nearly fucked it. She had the same Ivy Tramp stamp as the lady missing from our morgue. In fact, she appeared similarly tattooed in all the typical places from where I sat. She finished her set and disappeared into the trapdoor in the stripper pier. Next came a double act, a gothic bit with both girls in black lace with raven hair, black leather collar, pointy black boots, black lipstick, and black eyes. They had to go at the poles, then at each other, which very much pleased the crowd. And to both the previous blonde and the gothic duo, I handed a handful of my business cards along with cash tips as a sort of fishing expedition. The girls knew who I was by now, so if they were tempted to give the police any color analysis on the ever-cooling October 11 cases, they'd have the right contact information at hand. I went from there to the squeeze box as it was getting about 9 o'clock, and it was pretty lively scene, too. The redheaded act I had seen in Baby Blue here during a recent visit was up there again when I walked in, this time wearing a very few green sequins, possibly as few as 5 or 10. Or maybe the stage lights were just green and she was naked except for some glitter and a hat. Tipped her a wad of business cards herself, wrapped in 2 Jacksons, and sat down at the bar. I looked to the end of the bar to see Carrie Anders and Lewis Ho, and I waved. They sent me a pint of stout and then moved over to join me. Pretty friendly for meth heads. Thanks for the beer, I said. You guys doing okay? Ho nodded and grunted in the affirmative. And I'm doing better, Ricky. I've been born again, Carrie answered. She looked normal for her, although she had a new fever blister. A big one on her top left lip. She took a drag on her menthol, took a tug on her mixed drink, and blew smoke toward my ear. Moving ahead with my fishing expedition here, I told them that the 3 bodies had all been stolen from the morgue, and that the morgue down in Oakland had been fully pilfered also. No shit. I told you this whole deal was haunted. I suspected vampires, but hearing this, now I say zombies. We'll let you know if we see him, Ricky. She dutifully answered, oh, shit, I'm due backstage, and she ran off. With that, we all stood up, Ho headed out the front door, and Anders toward the back of the house, and I watched a couple of more acts, tipped my requisite cards and cash to each, including Anders. By now it was about 10, and I stopped back through the diner for coffees and caught up with the last several days' worth of newspapers until about 12:30, then drove on home. About 15 hours after I got home, Kitty walked in with a 6-pack, which ended in a 3-3 tie after a giggly hour of cigarettes and late-night TV in bed. And unlike her teammate, Kitty didn't disappear from the bed in the night, so she was still there when my phone woke us up at about 6. It was Wilson out of Oakland again. Thompson? Speaking, I answered. Sam Wilson again down in Oakland. All agencies are in as of about 10 minutes ago. And all the 11 October bodies are all gone now. Every damn one of them. Plucked from their respective morgues, he said. Once again, nobody saw nothing. Okay, thanks for the heads up. I'll catch up to you later this morning, I answered him. Hung up the phone, rolled back onto my kitty. We woke up again about 8. I figured no rush to chase dead people, at least not before getting a little more much-needed sleep. Kitty put on a pair of my sweatpants and an old shirt and left when I got out of the shower about 8:30. I'll say I had a Sandy for you, see you Saturday night, she said. I telephoned McKinney, heard from Oakland about 2.5 hours ago. You got anything? Just that all the 11 October girls are gone. Every agency involved, and uniformly no witnesses. And a uniform lack of good surveillance footage, either because of incidental system malfunction or blocked cameras or whatnot. Any extra men posted last night were circumvented on a coffee break or taking a piss or were just flat-out cat-burgled standing there flat-footed. And no forced entry anywhere, Rick, as far as anybody can tell. It's like those gals just got up and hoofed it off on their own. What's your game plan, I asked. Well, you stick with the liquors and keep an eye on their bookies, he said, and mind your other casework. Chances are that all this freaky shit will eventually just stop happening and leave us with a cold case all dressed up and nowhere to go. But better than a mystifying hot case. Get anything interesting last night? I bumped into Anders and Ho at the squeeze box. And I ran into one of the liquors at MC's, I said. Their next match is Saturday night. I got a few bills down on the liquors to win. You should join me. Yeah. Remind me to ask my wife, he grumbled. Lopez phoned me at the office about 11 in the morning. Maricopa County Sheriff's Office had contacted him earlier that day to report that the whole Phoenix Bloody Roller squad and the team they were hosting out of Flagstaff were gone too. Lopez began, or continued. Apparently, the Flagstaff team were due back home early this morning, according to their associates who reported their non-return to police. They remain unaccounted for, Lopez explained to me. The people in Phoenix have tried to check up on them through the rollers, but they can't raise anybody on the roller roster either. And I haven't heard from Veronica or Becca, but I've left them a couple of messages in the last 24 hours. They could all just be out partying through a Blue Monday, though, so it's hard to say for sure, what the deal is. But I wouldn't rule anything out, and if we never heard from any of them again, it wouldn't surprise me. Something else a little weird, too, Lopez went on. Investigators out there said some kind of Derby Circuit people they've been following up with this morning are reporting that last night was a no-show on the part of both squads, anachronistically. They say they showed up to watch the Phoenix Flagstaff match and none of the girls were there at all and never even showed up. But on the other hand, some people say they're talking to say the teams did show up and the gig went just fine. And it all went down normal and that they talked to the girls and are reporting the events of the match in detail. So how's that? About lunchtime, McKinney walked over to my desk. Dispatch just called up here and they say they have a black bag call that just came in for this residence. And he said, showing me the address on a notepad. Anders' apartment. And here we go. While I gathered my jacket and hat, the lieutenant sent word through dispatch for the medics to stand by on scene. Because of the sensitivity of the investigation, multiple murders, as it were, so as not to disturb anything insofar as it was possible, and we rolled on the call. And the EMTs were easily able to grant our request not to touch anything or anybody without violating any obligation of theirs to render first aid, because everyone in Anders' apartment was clearly stone dead. And that was obvious at first glance. Anders' body was completely bare, bent over the wooden coffee table. Ho was dead as a mackerel, seated on the couch in front of the coffee table. Between his and Anders' bodies was a third nude corpse, a female, but different, inasmuch as the girl in the middle was furry all over. Not only was Ho's cock still inside of the wolf lady, but the blade that he'd stabbed her with some innumerable times was sticking out of her also. And she'd bled all over him and all over the couch and all over Anders, who appeared to have been killed by the very sharp teeth of the wolf woman, now deceased, in between them, who had bitten big fleshy chunks out of Anders. Her body had deep puncture wounds, gouges, and bites from the wolf lady's claws and teeth all over what was left of her ass, legs, and back. And she'd bled out all over the coffee table and floor. A few of Louis Ho's errant blade swings at the lady wolf looked to have snagged Anders' lower body a couple of times, too. His death blows appeared to be the severe and deep cuts and gashes on his neck made by the back claws of the hirtus lady in the middle. The erstwhile hirtus lady in the middle. For now, anyway. There was a pap of coke dust and blood all over everything in the apartment, a thin layer. Ceiling, too. Likely, is for sure. The lieutenant lit a cigarette, and the smoke worked to buffer our olfactories from the scene and cleared the air a bit. "Take a look at this, Rick," McKinney said, and he lifted the wolf lady's ankles with his pen. He had a ballpoint pen that he'd pull out of his pocket, raising back the fur under which butterflies were tattooed on the skin of each ankle. Under the lower back fur, an ivy tramp stamp, and on the right wrist, a bangle. And under the fur on the nape of its neck was a small barcode tattoo. Looks like we've got one of our morgue fugitives back. Some form or another, more or less, he said. Guess that's our girl. $50, she gets out again, I said. McKinney shook his head, unwilling for the odds. Dixie's going to love this. Bag him up, guys.